Black history in Maine, dating back 3 centuries. February is Black History Month. Locally, the Maine Historical Society and Abyssinian Meeting House partnered to present a series of programs about African Americans in Maine. Organizers believe many people don't know about the role African Americans have played here, and they hope to change that. For example, did you know that there were people in Maine who owned slaves? Or that many free blacks worked as seamen in stevedores in Portland? And that Mainers played an important role in the Underground Railroad? The nation's first African-American Roman Catholic bishop, James Healy, served in Maine. And there's more. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today you'll hear from some of those who study Maine's African-American history. And we welcome you to share your stories about descendants or neighbors. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Maine's African-American community, though small compared to many other states, has a rich history that many people don't know about. Today, we're going to learn more about Maine's Black history and about the efforts being made to preserve some of that history. Joining me in our studio, Pam Cummings. She is president of the Board of Directors and Director of Education for the Abyssinian Meeting House. Kate McBrien is Director of Public Engagement and Chief Curator for the Maine Historical Society. And Leroy Rowe is a Professor of African American History and Politics at the University of Southern Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you want to know about Black history in Maine? Do you have stories to share? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. And Kate, you're the historian, so all of you are, really. But I want you to tell us about some of the earliest history of African Americans living here in Maine. What do we know?
Well, what we know is that with the very first Europeans that arrived in Maine, they brought Africans with them. So Maine's history starts with Native Americans. But as soon as the white Europeans arrived, Africans arrived with them. And that's what started Maine.
So we're talking late 1600s, early 1700s.
We're talking early 1600s.
Really?
Early 1600s. They've been here that long. And they've stayed.
Pam, I understand that by the end of the 1800s, there were cohesive communities of African Americans in Portland and Bangor. Tell me about these communities.
Yeah, the Abyssinian Meeting House, which was founded in 1828 by freed African Americans who were relegated to the pews in the church and felt that they deserved better treatment than that, and they weren't allowed to worship amongst the congregation. And so they became a thriving community and decided then and there that they were not going to allow anyone to treat them that way, and got funding and started to build the Abyssinian Meeting House. And at the Abyssinian Meeting House, they got together and they developed and devised strategies and plans for the freed slaves that were coming through to get to Canada because of the Fugitive Slave Act laws. And they needed to be escorted quickly in and out. And so they worked together for slave trade, and they worked collective. They were busy working African Americans in profitable jobs, usually at the waterfront.
These were people working at the waterfront mm-hmm. by day, mm-hmm. and by night, many, if not most, were involved in what we've come to call the Underground Railroad.
And that's exactly right. And with the Underground, which we now have called the Freedom Trail here in Portland. A lot of those sites on that Freedom Trail, and actually my father created that. He worked with a couple of the board members at the Abyssinian Meeting House to create that whole map of the people, and a lot of it had to do with the members of the Abyssinian Meeting House. They all had the shops, or they owned the homes, or the shops that were made available to those people that were coming through. So they're a very, very integral part of that Freedom Trail and the Underground Railroad here in Maine.
Leroy, how does Maine's and New England's African-American history relate to or differ from the history in the southern states?
Well, I think it's not much. There are certainly some difference, but we shouldn't look at Maine's history as something that is so peculiar that it doesn't fit in with the large narrative. African Americans have always been a resilient people. African Americans have always tried to seek out opportunities and live wherever they feel welcome, wherever they can work and make a living and support families and communities. And I think they did that here in Maine as well. One of the things that we find in New England is that there's always this rhetoric that supports this narrative that African Americans have not been here for very long, or that they have not really have a community that was vibrant, or that they hadn't contributed much to society, culture, or the economy of New England. And that's definitely not true. Slavery was an important part of New England's economy. Mm-hmm. African Americans might not have been in large numbers in much the same way that they were in the South as slaves, but they were nonetheless very important to Maine's economy for a variety of reasons. And the task that they did freed white folks up where they could leave the farms and go off to the cities. They could be ministers, they could be lawyers, they could be doctors, but the farms were taken care of by their African-American help, slaves. The docks in the port cities along New England were labor-intensive and drew from African slaves. So another important thing to remember, too, about African-Americans in New England is that not only were they integral to the Underground Railroad and to efforts to liberate their loved ones down south, that African Americans here themselves have also had to struggle to maintain their dignity and their communities here in New England because they were constantly under attack in various different ways.
The historian Kenneth Davis has been on this program a few times, and he points out that even Revolutionary era people who did not own slaves often profited from the slave trade. You see the ship captains' homes up and down the Maine coast. And Kate, you're nodding here. Kate, let me ask you about some of the luminaries. Tell us about some African American Mainers we ought to all know about.
Oh, there's several, actually. There's both ones that became famous and became very well known. There's Benjamin Lewis out of Bath. He was an African American who wrote this wonderful book, Light and Something. I'm blanking on the name right now, but
because you're on the radio.
Because I'm on the radio. That's how it works. But he actually drew attention to the harsh treatment that African Americans and Native Americans were receiving in New England. And it was widely published. It's still available in libraries. And it's still one of the earliest acknowledgments of looking at their treatment and not seeing the fairness that everyone or so many people recognize should have existed. At the same time, he was also an inventor. So he was this really creative guy who was active and knowledgeable and getting his word out, which was incredible. There was lots of people who were starting businesses, small groceries, cleaning businesses, liveries, who were serving their own community as well as their outside communities. There were the more not well-known people, not famous. I think of in Brunswick, there was Francis Houston, who was a very well-respected African-American member of the Brunswick community. Not rich, not part of the elite by any means, but he was able to buy up some land on the outskirts of Brunswick and start to sell land to fellow African-American residents so that they could actually start to own some property and begin to establish themselves and begin to stabilize their families and not be so reliant on others, as very often that was the only options that were available to them before that. So he started to strengthen his own community that way and became a real leader in that way, but quietly did it.
And interesting, I'm reading here that the nation's first African-American Roman Catholic bishop, James Healy, served here in Maine.
Right here in Maine, exactly. So Maine has had some well-known people. It's been a little bit scattered, and I think, unfortunately, the hard part for Maine's Black history is that we've forgotten so much of it.
I don't know that it's been forgotten. as much as it wasn't important. That it's to use the word forgotten would be a huge misservice and disservice. It's not forgotten. It hasn't. Nobody's wanted to know about it. They didn't want to ever. And it's not just Maine. Black people. They don't. We don't have a lot of history or records or. You know, and that's why it's really important moving forward. And the Abyssinian has created an archive of an oral history archive. So in 100 years, the children can come and they can find out who was here, what they did. Right now, there are so many people looking for so many answers to so many questions from before that we can't give to you.
Are you reaching out? Are you asking people to come forward if there's a story to tell for your archives?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we partner with MECA, and for 3 years we have done oral histories, and we'll continue to do that, and I continue to want to do that, and we're going to have on exhibit at the Abyssinian this whole collection. But it's really important because we can't, somebody says, well, do we have pictures of this person? And no, we don't have any pictures or my mother was a part of a women's group with the Amy Zion Church here in Portland that was really big for that time. And we can't find that anywhere. There aren't pictures. And these women did a great thing. It was a huge part of their social life. It's nowhere to be found.
There's probably pictures in attics somewhere that aren't labeled or...
It would be us, the black people that have the pictures. They wouldn't be... You can't go to... You know, a source at a library and find these things, you'd have to go, it'd be amongst us. And so there are a lot of people that their histories haven't been recorded and they haven't been told. And a lot of black people that have done a lot of really good things and it just hasn't been told. And it's up to us. We are the stewards of these stories and it's up to us to tell them because I feel that in now that a lot of our history is being forgotten and replaced and kind of being overshadowed by refugees and immigrant stories and history and information. So it's up to us. It's up to us to keep our stories alive and to keep our memories alive.
And I think actually Pam has a really good point that so much of that history was not seen as something of value. For so long. I do know in several of the archives at the museums and historical societies where I've worked, there are pictures of African Americans, but there's nothing written about who are these people? What is their story? Because at the time that they were collected, it wasn't seen as important. Mm-hmm. And so that's been a huge failing. And it's something that unless we can be lucky and stumble upon something else that will give us that identity, the names of those people, we may be able to see them in a photograph, but we won't be able to know their names because it's been lost to history.
Leroy, I want to ask you historically why Maine doesn't have a larger African-American population like so many other northern states do. You know, you think of Chicago, Illinois, Cleveland, Ohio. Is it because Maine didn't have the surge in industrialization? I mean, we did have some industrialization with the mills. Why not?
Well, I don't think you can definitely pin that down to one particular issue or so, but we do know that at the height of the Great Migration, that most African Americans went to places where there were jobs available and also where there were communities that could support that trained migration. But New England, in general, had seen significant patterns of migration, including here in Maine. There are enough records that suggest that African-American women, in particular single women, migrated to the northern part of New England in search of various different kinds of work, probably as domestics, sometimes in factories. We could think of, for instance, Worcester, Massachusetts, where as soon as slavery ended, we saw a train migration started. Janet Greenwood's book, First Fruits of Freedom, talks about how soldiers in the Union Army were able to help the slaves that they helped liberate to migrate to Massachusetts. And in fact, they built a prosperous community that did well up until a point where they began to do better than was expected. They started buying property. They started owning businesses and started competing with local whites for opportunities.
And then there was resentment.
And then there were resentment. Then there were effort to remove them. And I think Maine has, just like the rest of New England, have had some of that, where wherever there is a community that often prosper, it becomes more difficult. Local communities make it difficult for them to actually do well and to actually encourage relatives or friends to move into those communities. And that might be one of the reasons why Maine have not seen such sustained numbers of African Americans over generation.
Pam, the Abyssinian Meeting House that you're so involved in sits on Munjoy Hill, which is such an interesting place in Maine's history for so many reasons. When it was built, this was also a place where many Irish American and Italian American families were coming and coming for the first time. What was life like on Munjoy Hill for African Americans, and how did they fit in with this, you know, these other communities that were new to Maine and also often discriminated against?
I think that the immigrant population sort of displaced a lot of the African Americans. I was at a lecture with Kate had for our Black series, our Black History series this month. We had a woman that came in and she spoke to us, and she was telling us about the refugees and how they came in, not to take away from Munjoy Hill, and I will get back to that. But the people that had come here and they were working in the waterfront, which a lot of the African Americans were doing, and they found great deal of prosperity in working on the waterfront with the boats and the ships that were coming in. But they stopped using steel for the ships and started using wood, I believe she said, or they changed it. And with that, a lot of them lost their jobs because then they started going to factories. And factories, in fact, were more interested in hiring the immigrants than they were the African Americans. So when the African Americans lost their jobs to the manufacturing business, they lost money and they had a lack of income. And a lot of the immigrants then came in and took over those jobs. The immigrants that lived in the Abyssinian Meeting House were there when the Abyssinian was no longer the Abyssinian Meeting House. It was now an apartment building. And so they came in through that because the Abyssinian served as a schoolhouse too. I don't know if anybody knows, but they were Portland Public School for the African-American children here in the city of Portland. And so when that was over, the Abyssinian and the SS Portland sunk, and we lost a lot of the people that had the money because they were on that ship. The Abyssinian had to close its doors. They struggled for a while.
So when the SS Portland sunk, I didn't know that. Many of the founding members of the Abyssinian Church were on that ship?
Many of them were the people that had the money that provided for their households. They were on that ship.
And what year was that?
Kate, you've got to help me.
1898, I believe.
Yeah.
Wow.
Much of the choir of the First Parish Church went down on that ship as well. It was a massive loss for Portland, especially. Mm-hmm. But it devastated the Abyssinian Meeting House because without the families to help, you know, with the breadwinners to help support their families and then also support the Meeting House, it was difficult to continue.
Mm-hmm. Well, believe it or not, we already have to take a quick break. We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. You can email us at talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Maine Community Foundation, celebrating 35 years of investing in Maine communities. Learn more at mainecf.org. Next week on Speaking in Maine, we take you to the recent 31st annual Camden Conference.
Peace is in America's interest, and our leaders should not hesitate to say so.
How does this rise of populism affect American foreign policy?
The U.S. will need Europe, not just the other way around.
Renowned scholars, diplomats, and journalists from across the world address this year's theme, New World Disorder and America's Future. That's next week on Speaking in Maine, Monday through Thursday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Russian meddling in the 2016 election and the Mueller indictments with Scott Shane of the New York Times. He says the Russian social media campaign reached millions of Americans.
If you are provocative, if you are emotional, if you are extreme, you can stir up a whole lot of trouble.
He says the effort to divide Americans is still underway. Join us.
Fresh Air is tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Black History in Maine. Joining me today, Kate McBrien, who is Director of Public Engagement and Chief Curator for the Maine Historical Society. Leroy Rowe is University of Maine Professor of African American History and Politics. And Pam Cummings is President of the Board of Directors and Director of Education for the Abyssinian Meeting House in Portland. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Well, joining us on the line now is Patricia Wall. She is author of the book Lives of Consequence, Black and Early Kittery and Berwick in the Massachusetts Province of Maine. Thanks for joining us, Pat.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
What prompted you to research the lives of African Americans in Southern Maine?
Well, as so many research projects occur, curiosity. The Kittery Point Church was about to celebrate its 300th anniversary of its building, and I got to wondering who might have been up in the segregated galleries that were in the room in the church sanctuary. And one thing led to another, and I ended up doing research on the entire early parish of Kittery, which extended from Kittery Point clear on through all of the Berwick pieces.
Pat, what'd you find? How many African-Americans, and what kind of lives were they living?
Well, of course, I began first with records of the slave owners. And over a period of about 6 years, I compiled a list of 186 slave owners for just that one parish. And then there were 50 other white families who probably were also slave owners, but my documentation was not as exacting. In terms of the black population, in a way, I don't think we'll ever know the extent of the black population in Maine. What I could document or touch upon was somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 enslaved blacks in the region, and I'm sure that that number would have been at least double, if not more so, because children simply do not make it into the records, and black women certainly were no less fertile than white women. So it gives us a picture of a whole different population at the foundation of Maine, at the very beginning of Maine.
Pat, were you surprised? And as you've told people about what you found, are they surprised? I think a lot of people in Maine have a sense that there is not a history of slavery here.
Well, I've been traveling around giving talks through Maine, and I must tell you, and it's bragging, but the eyes never leave my face in the room. People just are astonished at what I found.
And you want to challenge people in other Maine communities to follow your lead, don't you?
Absolutely. My experience, you're not going to find it easily once you get past probate records and a few church records. You end up having to look at everything. I told my good friend, the historian from Portsmouth, Valerie Cunningham, I would call her up and say, oh, I found another person, and it was solely by serendipity. It was almost sometimes as if a black spirit from long ago was sitting on my shoulder telling me, now you take time and look at that book even though you don't think there's anything there. But it turns out that you just have to read everything you can lay your hands on connected with the community.
Well, Pat, before we let you go, what are your thoughts on why this is important to know and to share?
Well, I really think it's a bridge in the population, a bridge among us to understanding that America was black and white from the beginning. that the African people, even though enslaved, their labor very much counted in the founding of many communities throughout New England, and it's certainly evident in the early 1600s in those tiny settlements of Kittery Parish.
Well, Patricia, thanks so much for calling in. Patricia Wall is the author of Lives of Consequence, about the history of Black people in Kittery and Berwick when Maine was still a province of Massachusetts. Thank you, Patricia.
Thank you very much.
We'll go to Constantino, who's calling in from Westbrook. Hi, Constantino. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you today?
Great.
Excellent. I just wanted to weigh in. I'm a 60-year-old guy that grew up on Montjoy Hill. And I can tell you, I can attest that there were many African-American, Italian, and Irish communities, you know, families up there that everybody get along very well. And, you know, my dad was very popular. And I can recall lots of weekends where, you know, nobody had a lot. So there was lots of sharing, you know, weekend cookouts and things like that. The dads would drink beer and grill, and we'd play Frisbee on Federal Street, right near the Abyssinian church there. So
it was a good time. Pam, you were nodding.
Because I grew up in Portland. And so that was very much what Portland was like growing up. And I'm wondering, what is your last name?
My last name is Lallo, L-A-L-L-O.
Okay.
Yeah. Pam's figured it out. She knows your family, I think, yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, my dad was a very popular guy. He worked down on the pier and he went at Calderwood's Bakery.
Yeah, Calderwood's Bakery, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Constantino, thanks for calling in and sharing your story. I hope others will call in and share their remembrances as well. We'll go to Gerard, who's calling in from Waterville. Hi, Gerard. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I have, which you've been so gracious to do on a number of occasions, but anyway, I have a question about Robert Peary. He, of course, was the great Arctic explorer, which I've always, exploring subjects have always been quite an interest of mine. But he had a partner named, I believe it was Matthew Henson. And I know that Peary had ties to Maine. There's I believe he was a graduate of Bowdoin College. But does any of your panel know much about this Matthew Henson that was a partner of his?
I know a little bit. Admiral Peary was, he was a graduate of Bowdoin. He had a home on Eagle Island right off of Brunswick, which is still a preserved home, actually. And you can go visit it in the summer. It's quite a beautiful spot, actually. But yes, Matthew Henson went on his explorations with him, went to Greenland, went to the North Pole, and there's still some debate, actually, about which of them reached the North Pole first, whether it was Peary or actually Henson, and that Peary took credit for it because he was the leader, he was the white guy. So there's actually some debate out in the field right now about that, but Henson went with him on all his explorations and was right by Peary's side the entire time.
What do we know about Henson? Is he from Maine?
You know, I don't know a lot about his background. I'm not sure he is from Maine, and I'd have to look that up. But he did work with Peary for a number of years. So I don't know a lot about him personally.
All right. Gerard, thanks so much for calling in with that. And if you'd like to call in with your question or story, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, and post to our Facebook page. And there is an Arctic Museum at Bowdoin College, and I'm sure that there's information up there about not only Peary's
They can definitely tell you more about Henson. So I would recommend going to the Arctic Museum, going out to Eagle Island as well. Both places would be able to tell you more about Henson.
I want to ask you, Kate, also about, I know you've done a lot of research over the years about Malaga Island. And I think a lot of people know about it now, but many don't. So why don't you tell us about that and why it's so important for us to understand what happened? We're talking about the Brunswick area, correct?
It is. It's the Phippsburg area, so right near Brunswick. Malaga Island was a small island right off of Phippsburg where a small community of African-American and white people married and lived together. They started a community there, we think, around 1863 and lived in peace. I mean, everyone knew they were there. No one really bothered them much until the turn of the 20th century. And that's when we start to see a lot more visible racism in Maine come across. And it certainly was the case for Malaga. That's where more and more people paid attention to this different community that was living very openly. And eventually it got to the point that in 1912, the state evicted the community, institutionalized some of them in the Maine School for the Feeble-Minded, and even exhumed the cemetery, took everything. So that the state thought there was no evidence. But archaeologists from the University of Southern Maine have done digs out on the island and found quite a bit of evidence of the community. So while the newspapers and the state at the time had lots of their own version of the story and myths that they were creating about this Malaga Island community, thanks to the archaeologists at USM, we actually have the physical evidence to show us who the community really was and how they really were living, so we can understand a lot more.
We'll go to Helen calling from Norridgewock. Hi, Helen. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. I have a friend who lives on Munjo Hill in Portland, and she sent me a question about a camp in Smithfield, Maine, which is where I live. And she said she was looking in the Green Book, which is a publication by and for blacks that ran from 1937 to the 60s to help give blacks information about safe and welcome gas stations and rooms to stay in when traveling. And there was only one mention in that book of Maine, and that was Camp Beulah. It was an advertisement, and for Camp Beulah in 1938 in Smithfield, Maine, a camp for boys of good moral character between the ages of 10 and 18 years. Camp ran from June 24th to September 10th and cost a grand total of $7.50 a week. And I've never heard of it, and I don't know of anybody in this neighborhood who has heard of it. Do you know anybody who knows about it? Was it on North Pond or East Pond or something not on a pond?
I'm not sure. I know of homes that people had that housed people of color for the summer, you know, during the summer. My family, the Cummings family, had a home in Old Orchard Beach that a lot of people stayed, a lot of famous people stayed. I know the Richardson's family had a home that they as well had a lot of black people that stayed, that came through. And I know there's a home in Kennebunk that also the people would stay, felt safe, and knew that they come and stay in Maine. I'm not familiar with this camp, but something that might be worth looking into.
Yeah, Helen, you had three historians writing notes while you were talking.
I have a new research project.
Pretty soon we're going to know a little bit more about this. Well, thank you so much for calling in. This is really interesting, Pam. So your family and other families operated what was kind of like a bed and breakfast so people could come on a vacation in Maine and feel safe.
Oh, yeah. I have on our Facebook page, the Abyssinian Meeting House Facebook page, I've included that. In Black History Month, I highlight a lot of these things. And yeah, we had a house, and it just recently sold. And actually, they were going to demolish it, and because there's so much history there of guests that came, the black performers that weren't allowed to stay in the hotels in Old Orchard Beach.
So these are the people who performed on the pier.
Yes. And they came and they stayed with them, and my cousins and my aunts and uncle. They owned the home. And for years, they had a lot of people, a lot of really famous people.
So you have to tell us a story. What's a good story about one of these famous performers? So now that I put you on the spot, you're going to...
I know that in a book was written, my Aunt Ann, she was one of the children there. It was my Uncle Eddie's brother, I believe, that owned the home. And she lived in the home, and somebody that came wrote a book about her. And it's on Facebook, too. I don't have the name of it. I mean, there are a lot of different stories that... obviously, I can't think of right this minute.
Well, I believe the guest log is actually at USM in the special
cousin.
Collection.
Yeah, oh, my cousin LaVon, my Uncle Eddie's, and that's her family.
Yeah, and so you could actually, the African-American collection of Maine history is at USM, the Library Special Collection, and you could actually see the guest log, and you can see the signatures of I believe, Duke Ellington and these various jazz musicians that would stay at the Cummings house.
That's right.
Really fascinating. Students actually love to see these signatures because you play their music in their classes, you talk about these individuals, but then they could see that they actually came to Maine.
Oh, that must be really fun for you as a professor.
Yeah, it's cool.
I forgot about that. Yeah, yeah. He's right.
That's really neat. But what's so interesting to me about this phone call is I didn't know about the Green Book. Mm-hmm. And that this was a book that people who are traveling, African Americans who are traveling, could check places if mm-hmm. they're going to a state. But that there was only one entry for Maine. Was it because Maine was not a safe place to travel in the early 1900s?
No, I don't think. Maybe you could answer better to that. I don't know.
I don't know why. I just suspect that there were many places in Maine because African Americans vacationed in Maine. W.E.B. Du Bois the FBI couldn't find him sometimes for 2 weeks out of the month every year. There'd be 2 weeks where they can't find him, and he'll be in Maine mm-hmm. Vacationing. And in fact, the Green Book is very important because if you ask African Americans during the height of the Jim Crow period, what affected them most about Jim Crow, what they felt more torn up about, it was the insult that they would suffer while traveling on the interstate or while taking public transportation. And so it was an issue of safety. It was also about your personal dignity. And having that resource to tell you where would be a safe place for you to stop off and bring your family, your children, was pretty critical because if you're traveling for days and sometimes for hundreds of miles and not knowing where you'll stop to get a meal or where you could stop to get a rest, you can imagine what that would feel like for someone. And I think such a resource was certainly important to survive the oppressive system of Jim Crow.
And I think, too, you know, we have this narrative that Maine never had racism, which is so not true. Certainly not true today. Certainly never true, not even in the 17th century, 18th century, 19th, 20th. So it was important to have these resources where even coming to a state that there may not have been a lot of African Americans here, you needed to know where you could go, where you could be safe, where you would be welcomed. And so something like the Green Book would be just as crucial in Maine as it would elsewhere in the United States.
Sure. Well, if you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talkinpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we take a quick break, a word about tomorrow's program. We are going to discuss the importance of arts to Maine's economy. What do you think the creative economy does for our state? Are you involved? Email comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet us or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does CEI, helping grow good jobs and sustainable enterprises with financing and business advising services. CEIMaine.org.
Intelligence Squared US, where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues. The next topic up for debate, have dating apps killed romance?
We make a mistake thinking that we can game this.
Technology is changing the way we court.
Nice legs, even if you don't shave them.
How happy do I have a right to be?
That's all coming up on Intelligence Squared US.
You can hear Intelligence Squared in about 20 minutes after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. The top high school quiz teams from Boston, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Maine will be competing later this spring to become the best in New England. High School Quiz Show Maine is now underway to find the Maine state champion. This week, Wells goes up against Scarborough, answering questions about Maine, science, current events, history, math, pop culture, and many other academic topics. So which school will ultimately come out on top here in Maine, and how will they do against other New England states? You can watch the face-off and test yourself along the way tonight at 8 o'clock and Sunday afternoon at 5:30 on Maine Public Television. For more information about High School Quiz Show Maine, what's involved, how to form a team and register for next year, or maybe to watch past contests, you can visit mainepublic.org and click on television.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the history of African Americans in Maine. Joining me today, Leroy Rowe, a USM professor of African American history and politics. Pam Cummings is president of the board of directors of the Abyssinian Meeting House. And Kate McBrien is chief curator for the Maine Historical Society. Join our conversations. Our number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Marianne who writes, I thought I'd mention in that the early 1800s, up to 30% of crew members of ships were African American. And to her email, she attached tables from a book published by Harvard University. She says, Bob Green is a great source on Black history, particularly of his family. You all are nodding there.
Bob's fabulous.
We're going to go to Steve in Ellsworth. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hey, hi, folks. How you doing? Hey, great story telling today. Excellent panel. I was wondering if you had any knowledge about the African-American community a little bit outside of the Giants there. I had read a sort of a vanity publication about the settlement there, and it was pretty interesting. I think even one of the folks there, you know, fought the first naval revolutionary battle with the Margarita and all this sort of stuff. But any more about that? Or was this big news?
I don't know a lot of details about it, but I do know there was a community outside of Machias. They were a fairly strong community for quite a while. Not a large community, but strong, and they had a presence there. And I don't know a lot of details, unfortunately. But I do think it's a great example of the fact that there were African-American communities up and down the coast and in the interior of Maine. This is not just a southern Maine phenomenon. It's not just a Portland-centered history. This is all of Maine's history. And it's important that we know that these communities would spring up and support each other throughout the state, wherever they could find opportunity to work and live and support their families.
Steve, thanks so much for calling in. We're going to go to Brunswick and Dorothy. Hi, Dorothy. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. I'm doing research on a Nigerian chief professor who's studied at Virginia Union from 1906 to 1916. And when I was in the Peace Corps in Nigeria, we bonded because he was important in the town where I was living, because he said that he had worked in a hotel on Prout's Neck probably around 1910 to 1916. And the Black Point Inn wasn't there then, that I've been able to find out. But does anyone know of a large hotel that might have been in the area where a Black man might have worked?
Well, it was very common for African Americans to work in the hotels in the labor industry, either cleaning.
Well, there was, but I mean, were there any that you know of in that area? Or do you have any ideas?
I don't know of specific hotels in that area, but we could certainly take a look. You know, the Maine Memory Network, I would check that to see what resources there may be. And I can certainly poke around at the Maine Historical Society. We've got a vast archive.
Okay, Dorothy, call Kate later on. Thanks so much. We're going to go to Chrissy, who's calling from Sydney. Hi, Chrissy. Go ahead.
Hi. I live in Sydney, but actually I'm a pastor in Winthrop. And I was wondering if you all had any knew any of the history of the Underground Railroad as it came through this part of central Maine. A longtime pastor of my congregation, the stories they tell about him is that he helped organize the people who were fleeing north that came through Winthrop, particularly in some homes in the Metcalf Road neighborhood. And I went on a history tour last year, and they'd showed us a home where there are places in the home. It's a very old home that still where they could have hid people in the walls. So I didn't know if you all knew any more about the history of this part of the state for that era.
Okay, thanks, Chrissy.
Actually, the Abyssinian Meeting House for the longest time was the only recognized site for the Underground Railroad. Now the Harriet Beecher Stowe House is also so we're the only two official sites. So there are a lot of people that, you know, claim to have been a part of the Underground Railroad. I don't know of any evidence. I do know that we had to produce a tremendous amount of evidence to be, you know, the credentials that we have now for. Mm.
But there would have had to be other places, though, because it took a long time to travel back then. So there had to be some place where people could go.
Yeah. I know the Abyssinians' role in that, which was to get people to, you know, bring them in and rush them, grab them from the docks or the train and whisk them off to where they were held safely to the next point. What that next point was, I don't know. I know that there that the Underground Railroad, that the folks at the Abyssinian Meeting House were quite instrumental, and that's all I know.
So there's a few things that we know about the Underground Railroad in Maine. Of course, the whole point of the Underground Railroad is that it was secret. And so things weren't written down, and that's a big reason why we don't know a lot of the details of the sites, because it would have been too dangerous to document that. But we do know that a lot of the African-American communities that were scattered throughout the state were a spot where a runaway slave could go and hide. I do know of one documented case of that in Brunswick. Frances Houston actually married a woman who was her owners had brought her up from the South to summer in Maine, and she ran while she was here, and the Houstons hid her and were able to keep her protected until they could secure her freedom. So there are a few cases of that, but they're mostly stories that are told years later. We're not always sure exactly how accurate they are, but that was the point of the Underground Railroad, keep it secret. So detailed homes, there's lots of stories. There's very little evidence to definitely prove it.
All right, Chrissy, thanks so much for calling in. We're going to go back to Patricia. Patricia, thanks for calling back.
Oh, sure. I just wanted to add something. There's a place in Kittery Point called Rock Rest, which was a tourist home for Black people and did appear in various editions of the Green Book.
Great. And Pam's nodding and smiling as you say this. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the home that I was telling you about earlier.
Yeah.
The three that I knew of, Richardson's, Cummings, and
I don't know if you'd covered that.
Yeah, thank you so much, Patricia, for calling back. And another note from our producer, the book you were talking about, Kate, is Light and Truth from Ancient and Sacred History, Robert Benjamin Lewis, published January 1st, 1843. We'll go to Rebecca, who's driving, hopefully safely, in New Hampshire. Hi, Rebecca. Go ahead.
I'm actually pulled off and parked and listening to your show. I came in the middle of it. But it reminded me, in the 40s, I was a girl in Gorham, Maine, and we had a friend stay with us. His name was Roland Hayes, and a famous singer in Portland. And he used to stay with us because he sang in Portland at a big place. I can't remember where it was. And I just wonder, did he have to stay with us because there were no other places for him to stay in?
Rebecca, what year was this? What year?
In the 40s.
Yeah, I don't know. My aunt's from, I had an aunt who lived in Gorham, Anne Searcy. And she was part of the Cummings family that their family was in Old Orchard Beach. And I don't know when she moved there, but.
Yeah, maybe. Interesting, Rebecca. Thank you for calling in and sharing that. I want to ask you, Kate, about Maine's colleges and what kind of role they have played in the history of African Americans in Maine.
So for Maine, they were actually, Bowdoin and Bates were both very early in educating African Americans, actually allowing them in as students. But they also had several professors that were very involved in the abolitionist movement before the Civil War, too. I know there was at Bowdoin College, there used to be a medical school there. They actually were educating a few African-American students to be doctors. Some had the plans of being doctors and then moving to Liberia. There was a big movement for that, to be able to care for communities there. So Brunswick was involved. Bowdoin actually has the Russworm Center named after an African-American student who was there. That actually helps them to focus on African-American history in that region.
Russworm was big for the African-American community because he had one of the first newspapers for African-Americans. So he's a big one.
And that started out of Bowdoin
when
he was there.
Caroline writes, I'd like to hear what the guests might know about the African-American community around St. John Street in Portland, particularly the relationship between that community and the Union Station train station.
Mm. My family again. That's what happens when you grow up in Maine. Yeah, it is. My uncles, Tate, Eddie, and Eugene, were the Red Caps at the train station there. And they were very, very busy people and went on to work at the airport, and their family was a very thriving family. They owned a lot of real estate down there. Still, a few homes belong to a few of them, and it was a very, very, very active African-American community. The Richardsons as well.
Nina writes that, talking about, is it Malaga's, that there's a children's book, Lizzie Bright and the Buckminster Boy,
excellent,
by Gary Schmidt. Okay,
yep.
Excellent young adult book. Well, we're almost out of time, but I want to ask you all in the time we have left, and Leroy, connecting the Black history in Maine to what you're teaching today and the African-American community in Maine that really is so much more varied than it was now that we have the new Americans, leave us with some thoughts. What do we think about in the 21st century when we think about this community?
Well, I do think the possibilities are great, and one of the things that I try to do in my courses is to always demonstrate how and why things are the way they are, and what we can learn from the African-American experience in Maine and throughout the country is vital to newcomers to understand how to negotiate the American democratic experience, and how to equip themselves to be able to push on through and to overcome many of the challenges that they will face going forward. And I do think Maine in general, I see so much optimism, especially from white Mainers who want to know more about African-American history and to learn more about the other, because they recognize that this is a time in which they have to share space and communities with these individuals. And so they have to equip themselves as well to better understand relations and build relationships going forward. So there's enormous opportunities and possibilities.
And Pam, in the few seconds we have left, tell me about the status of the renovations. When are you going to be done? Do you have any idea at the Abyssinia Meeting House?
The basement, we're in the final stages of kind of finishing up down there so that we can make that space available, program spacing available. We have a lot of curriculum programs that we've developed for the Abyssinian Meeting House specifically. We are the upstairs. We have four exhibits that'll be there this summer.
Wow.
There's some means so that when you're coming in, you're no longer just looking at the space. We have some actual things of substance that are going to begin to happen. And I do want to say that what you have just said, and that is that find your history in our history, because the Abyssinian Meeting House, and I would invite you to find your history, because there is a story of resiliency, the human spirit soars, and how we can all collectively work together to make beautiful things happen.
Beautiful way to end the program. Thank you. That was Pam Cummings, President of the Board of Directors and Director of Education for the Abyssinian Meeting House. Kate McBrien's also here, Director of Public Engagement and Chief Curator for the Maine Historical Society, and Leroy Rowe, Professor of African American History and Politics at USM. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.